During Northwest Weekend, I was privileged to attend the many seminars that were offered there. One of the presenters is a friend of that I've had for a number of years. I've gotten to know at serving with him at preteen camp. His name is Tim Hendrickson, and the title of his seminar just jumped out at me and made me want to listen. It was called Own It, Don't Rent It, Your Relationship with God. Own It, Don't Rent It, Your Relationship with God. I thought, now there's a title that not only tells you where it's going, but makes you want to know more. After listening to his presentation, I asked him if he minded taking this topic and using it for a sermon, and he was certainly happy to see that it, you know, would have a life past that seminar. And so I took it, and I've worked with it for a number of days and weeks, thinking about how to approach this, and I've put it together in this sermon, the concept of owning and not renting our relationship with God. You know, it hits home for a number of reasons. What do you think about when you think about renting? You might think about your home, as many rent. While there's obvious differences between owning and renting a house, my mind, though, went back to when I was a kid. Because when I was a kid, my parents owned the house we lived in, and the thought of owning or renting wasn't something that I really thought about, except when you thought about renting, the thing that came to mind was movies. Growing up, if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go and see a movie. The idea of bringing a movie home wasn't really an option. We had, when I think it was in junior high school, we knew somebody that bought one of these LaserDisc players. And the movies came in multiple platters and these giant things that they would put in. We didn't know anyone that had one of the VCRs that were, even though the VCRs were, you know, go back to the late 50s and early 60s, nobody really had one in the 1970s. It wasn't until the later 1970s that they really began to mass produce them. And when they first came out, you know, they were about $1,000 to buy one. And 1978, $1,000 was a lot of money. In fact, I went online and I found a place that showed old catalogs, Christmas catalogs for each year for Sears and Penney's and Montgomery Ward's. And I thought, I wonder when they started putting VCRs in these catalogs, because I'm trying to remember when we were actually first able to rent a movie and watch it. And I think it was either 78 or 79 before you finally saw it in one of these catalogs, a VCR, and they were over $1,000. So I do remember when we first found out that the video rental store down the street had one for rent, and if you didn't have a credit card, they wanted a hefty deposit before they're going to let you take this giant suitcase with a VCR in it, the weighed, you know, seemed like it weighed a ton, home, and then you'd have to figure out how to hook it up to your TV set. And unlike TV sets today that are designed to hook up to computers and all these peripherals, TV sets in those days didn't hook up to anything. You know, some of them you had to hook up to the place where the antenna went into. So, you know, they weren't even cable ready, as we use the term today. So I do remember when we got to rent a movie, it was a very special occasion. And it wasn't until I got back from college that my parents actually owned a VCR. And I asked them how much it cost, and they said, oh, $800. A few years later, I was able to buy one after I got married, and I think we paid we found a receipt for it, $230 for this thing in like 1991 or so. So it was a big deal. Renting a movie at home was a really big deal. So the concept of what renting was, it also reminded me of being at the feast. You would rent at the feast. You might get to rent a car, although we almost never did growing up, but you'd rent a place to stay. Maybe it was a motel. Maybe you were lucky enough to have a hotel or a condo. But, you know, it was temporary. Rental meant temporary. And, of course, for many homeowners, they start off by renting. When my wife and I first got married, we lived in an apartment. And I remember having to carry the laundry down to the laundry room because we didn't have hookups in our rental. And the next place we rented, I wanted to make sure there was washer and dryer hookups, because carrying that laundry down there was not my favorite. Now my wife is giving me this look like, who did the laundry? Come on. It's transparent, you know. But I do remember remember what it was like to rent an apartment. You know, when you think about renting versus owning, there's a lot of differences. When you own a house and something breaks, you say, I need to fix this. It's mine. You know, my family needs this, and so I have to fix it. And so you take personal responsibility to fix what that is. We owned a house in California, and I remember having to take personal ownership over a lot of things. A new roof, new floors, plumbing, new bathroom fixtures, sprinkler systems for the yard, all sorts of landscaping, probably broke us, all the things that we had to take ownership of. When you rent and things are really bad, I guess you always have the opportunity to find something else to rent. But ownership means it's your problem, something you have to deal with. Rental is something that's temporary. When you think about renting, especially things at the feast and special occasions, you ever thought about your relationship with God? That at times you were in a relationship where you rented, not owned. Think of the times that you've had in your life that you've had really fervent prayer. You were desperate. You were really in need. And so you come to God in fervent prayer. Was that something that you did on a regular basis? Or maybe your relationship with God got neglected and now you were in a pickle. I remember getting lost as a kid. I was 6 or 7. We lived in Arizona. My brother and I went on a camping trip with some friends of ours that lived down the street. And although I don't remember where this was in Arizona because there was a forest, and none of the places we lived in Arizona had a forest, unless palm trees counted as a forest. But where we were camping, probably in northern Arizona, there was a forest. And I remember going down to this stream to play with the other kids that we were staying with. And you had to walk down this long path and around this pretty big hill. Earlier in the day, or the day before, we were sliding down this hill. It was kind of a pretty steep hill, and we could set up things and slide down. It was fun. And in my mind, at 6 or 7, I was saying, you know, where we went, we were on the backside of this same hill. So I said, you know, when we were done playing at this stream or whatever it was, I said, you know, I think we could go up and over that hill and get right to the camp. It's a shortcut. None of the other kids were interested in shortcuts. I remember being interested in shortcuts my whole life, and as they say, the longest distance between two points is a shortcut. And so at a very young and tender age, I decided I was going to go find my way over this hill, and they all went the old path on the way back. When I got over that hill and I came down the other side, I realized camp was nowhere around, and I couldn't figure out where I was. I thought about going back, but I wasn't sure that was the best thing either. Besides, it's probably over the next hill. Maybe there was two hills, and I didn't see that the fact that there. And it was a short time that I was good and lost. I don't know that I was gone for much more than a half an hour to an hour. I don't remember because, as I remember, no one came out looking for me. I don't know that they thought I was missing yet. And there's the laughs. Maybe they didn't want to find you. But I do remember starting to get panicked about the situation, and I do remember praying as a kid. Now, you know those kind of prayers you get. God, if you only get me out of this, I'll do this, that, and the other thing. And you're willing to make just about any kind of promise when you're in trouble. And I remember having a number of these prayers. At one point, I sat down on the stump, and I was pretty upset. And I was sitting down, just wondering what to do. My head was down in my hands for prayer. And finally, I got up and walked a few feet, and I was right back in camp. To this day, I remember how nice it was to have God intervene in your life and help you out. But do we have a relationship with God to where we know that God has our back, that wherever we go in life, whatever we might get ourselves into, whatever troubles come our way, we have such a close relationship with God that when trouble hits, we can say, God, how did this happen? What do I do? Help me through this. Did I miss something? What am I learning? What do I need to do? Or do we find ourselves kind of in that rental relationship where we don't really go to God until the times we really need Him? Like we're saving Him up for a really bad. I don't want to waste a prayer on today because nothing really bad is happening today. I'm going to wait till something really bad happens because then I'll have something to talk about. I remember the summer between my first and second year of college, I had this great idea that I would take a car to college the next year. Now, I had sold my car the previous year to a friend of mine and went off to college. Of course, I didn't get any of the money from the car because my friend noticed there were some problems with it. Instead of paying me for the car, decided to go out and see if he could get these problems solved. And after dumping what he thought was a small fortune into it, finally decided the car wasn't worth fixing. So when I got back, I just repossessed the car and said, well, you haven't paid for it. I'm taking it back, and I'll fix it. And I had a job between the 2 years of school. And so I started taking some of that money I was making and trying to fix this car up. I don't remember consulting God about my decision. I don't remember saying, God, I need so much money to get back to school. I pretty much figured it out that pretty much everything I make during the summer is going to be needed to get back to school. So should I divert a third or half of it to fixing this car so I'll have a car? I didn't ask God. Probably because I didn't want to know the answer. You ever notice that? If there's things in your life that you probably think I should be going this way instead of that way, they don't make it into your prayer life. You just sort of omit those things. I know I have. If there's something you don't want to know the answer to, you just leave that out. You're willing to talk about other things. You'll give God, hey, I've got this problem over here. I've got this solution over there. What do you need me to do? I'll do all these things, but I'm not going to mention this part of my life that I've really much, pretty much made up my mind what I'm going to do. And so that car problem pretty much broke me. And some people in the church down there in Southern California came together and helped me out to get me back to school, or else I wouldn't have had the money I needed to even go for my second year. It's one of these things where we don't involve God in our day-to-day walk, and we get ourselves in trouble because we're renting our relationship with Him. I remember getting very angry with God. That I remember vividly. I remember coming out of this transmission shop after putting this transmission. I had to buy a transmission for this car, and I couldn't afford a new one, so I figured I was going to do really well, buy one from a wrecking yard. And if you put it in, it doesn't work, you can take it back anyway, so it's a win-win, I thought. Of course, it took me over 30 days to put it in, and that was the warranty. And 35 days after I bought it, I went back to there and said, this doesn't work, and they said, too bad. And I remember being very angry with God when I was at the transmission shop, and they said, yes, we're going to have to rebuild it, it's going to cost this much money. It was most of what I had left. And they said, we really should replace all of it. And I said, I don't have enough money to fix all of it. I only have enough to fix this part. And so I fixed just that part. And guess what? The part I didn't fix broke. I was mad. Do you think that it went through my mind that I was on the road, wrong road? That maybe I shouldn't have spent all this money that I had previously worked out was going to go to college? That maybe I shouldn't have repossessed the car from my friend, but maybe helped him work out some way to get it fixed if he wanted to, or sell it and pay him back for all the money he put in? Because after all, I sold him a lemon. I didn't do it knowingly. But he was out a lot of money. I was out a lot more. But I was angry with God because I left him out of the decision and it went poorly. And now I was stuck. My problems were not God's fault. I had obligations I was not living up to. I could have let my friend keep the car and, like I said, maybe even retain my friendship with him, but it ruined our friendship. What's more important? In back of my mind, I wanted a car at college. I actually did finally get that car fixed. I took it to college. spent way too much time and effort on it while I was at school. Turned out to be a pretty big distraction, and I ended up selling it for about 20% of all the money I put into it. But it was a tremendous lesson in my life. If I had taken ownership of my relationship with God, then I would have probably decided not to even attempt that car and said, that's a bad decision. I would have gone back to school with the money. I would have had a way better success financially going back to school. And I would have probably maintained my friendship. You know, this theme of ownership versus rental lends itself to the concept of taking ownership of a problem or a task. And I think about the time I spent in construction in California where I was a foreman. And as a foreman, you're given the responsibility to get things done at a certain time frame. They say, we want this project done by this date and this date. And they hire all these people to work for you. And they may have been professionals, they may do great work, but they haven't agreed to the timeline. They may feel that they're doing a great job, but I've got a timeline to meet. It's my responsibility to get it done. And so you try to motivate these guys and get them to work. And they're like, hey, I only got two hands. There's always tomorrow. Why are you in such a hurry? When you have ownership of something, you go that extra mile. It's important to you. You know, it makes me think of John 10, if you want to turn over to there. John 10. It's talking about the differences between a good shepherd and a hired hand who's put in charge of the sheep. A hired hand is not the owner of the sheep. He's really not invested in them. In John 10, verses 11 through 13, it says, I am the good shepherd. This is speaking of Christ here. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. A hired hand will run when he sees a wolf coming. He will leave the sheep because they aren't his, and he isn't their shepherd. And so the wolf attacks and scatters the flock. The hired hand runs away because he is merely a hired hand and has no real concern for the sheep. If you take ownership of a problem, then you're going to see that problem through the end. This hired servant was just being rented, and he was only there for the time being as things went a certain way. When things went bad, he left. So I remember this idea of taking ownership of a problem. And when you do, employers really see that and they really like the fact that you're a go-to person. You get done what you say you're going to do. You don't come back and say, well, I couldn't do it. Wasn't possible. Because then they end up finding somebody else who can't, isn't in their vocabulary. But this idea of rental, I had a friend in college that had this kind of a funny phrase, at least seemed funny at the time. Now it seems kind of terrible when I think back on it. But he had this really nice car. It's part of the reason I wanted to bring my car, because he had a car, I had a car, we could go and do things together. We usually got in trouble when we got our cars together. We went to two different holy days where we brought dates, and we were going to go out on holy days and have this great time where all the other students at college had to take buses. But we would go out because we had cars, and therefore we had opportunities that they didn't have. It pretty much gave my friend a speeding ticket each every year that he went out in that car. And one year we went to Louisiana for services because, you know, Louisiana at the time had a drinking age of 19. And even though we were over 21, some of our dates weren't, and we thought, this is going to be just a wonderful holy day. We drove all the way from Big Sandy to Louisiana, and had a wonderful trip after we got done with the speeding ticket. We got there, and guess what? There was no church there. There was no church. The whole church had gone somewhere else for the holy days. We didn't know until we got there. So this car got me in more troubles than you'd know. But my friend had this kind of a cruel phrase that he used to use. When he talked about, hey, we should go and we should rent a car, because you know what you do with a rental, don't you? You thrash it. That's what he used to say. What do you do with a rental? Thrash it. Always get the insurance, he says, because, you know, if you're going to go stump jumping, you need to have that insurance. But his car he owned, and his car he took immaculate care of. He had one of those covers you put over it. It was a nice sporty car, had one of those turbo gauges. I'd like to get him at least 2 speeding tickets that I was aware of. But when you own it, you take better care of it than when you rent it. So do you turn to God when time gets bad, when life gets rough? Or do you stay close to God before? That's really what we're talking about today. It's like the old saying, there's no atheist in a foxhole. It was first credited to a sermon given during the Battle of Bataan when a pastor was said to have given the sermon talking about, you know, the enemy was closing in on them. They would eventually lose the Philippines and be taken prisoner. And in a sermon given, a preacher there was credited saying, there are no atheists in a foxhole. It was also credited to U.S. war correspondent Ernie Pyle, who traveled through Europe with U.S. troops, who later died with those troops. But when you spend a night in a foxhole and the bombs are coming all around you, people who said that they don't have a relationship with God generally find a relationship because they're scared. Turn over to Ecclesiastes. Lisa's reading through her Bible, and she went recently through Ecclesiastes, and she says, you know, it's a really tough book to get through because it talks a lot about the meaningless of life and how so much that we do just really doesn't matter. It's kind of depressing. And I can see where she gets that feeling, especially when you read in Ecclesiastes 12, the last chapter of Ecclesiastes. And verse 8, it says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. NIV puts it this way, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, everything is meaningless. And even though it seems bleak, we have to read the context to know what they're being said. And this is a theme throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Let's go back to chapter 11 in verse 9. Kind of gives you the kind of theme that's going on. And it says, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes, but know that it is for these things God will bring you into judgment. So it's talking about the idea that when you're young, your whole life's ahead of you. Everything is a possibility. Everything is wonder. Everything is wonderment. But if you're not careful, and you don't think about your plan, the life you're supposed to be living, you're going to end up having an answer for your life. In verse 12, or chapter 12, verse 1, it says, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come and the years draw near, when you say, I have no pleasure in them, while the sun and the light, the moon and the stars are not darkened, and the clouds do not return after the rain. What are they talking about here? They're talking about getting older, something we all are starting to feel in one way or the other. And parts of our bodies start breaking down, and it gets hard to get up. And you start thinking, wow, life is getting much tougher. I was reading this in the New Living Translation. I think it says it better, though. It says, do not let the excitement of youth cause you to forget your Creator. Honor Him in your youth before you grow old and no longer enjoy living. It will be too late then to remember Him when the light of the sun and the moon and the stars are dim in your old eyes and there is no silver lining left among the clouds. You see, people by their very nature seek happiness in life. We all try to do it. What do you want to do today? Now, at this moment, your mind immediately goes to, I would rather this, or I want to do that. And we fill our lives with that which we seek, which is fulfillment of some sort, happiness. It's not always the best thing for us. It's not always finishing what we started, the goals that we set. A lot of times those get pushed all away on the side of the road. Sometimes we have an idea that we're going to have a good, close relationship with God, and then life gets in the way. Expositor's Bible Commentary talks about Ecclesiastes and calls this chapter 12 this way, the frustration of old age. It says, the rhythm of life is like the rhythm of the year. Spring and summer give place to the clouds of autumn and winter. The showers that so quickly come and go in youth are succeeded by rain and clouds and then more rain. It becomes progressively harder to throw off troubles and anxieties. So this idea that if you compare a year, it starts off in the spring when all is new and there's such possibilities, and you go through the summer, and then if you don't accomplish what you need to, how tough are the winter months? If you haven't prepared the way you need to, the winter months can be really harsh. If you didn't get your firewood, if you didn't get your food put away, if you didn't prepare for the cold, patch the holes in your roof, all those things, the winter can be very tough. And so can our life if we haven't prepared when we're younger. So what Ecclesiastes is telling us is that as long as life is, it's actually very short. We need to take account of how we go through our life and the relationship that we have with God and with others, and ask ourselves, are we making the most of all the possibilities that God gives? We can see the conclusion of the matter as we read the last few verses of Ecclesiastes 12. It sums it up this way. Starting in verse 11, I'm going to read this in the New Living. Again, I think it says it so much clearer. A wise teacher's words spur students to action and emphasize important truths. The collected sayings of the wise are like guidance from the shepherd. But my child, be warned, there is no end of opinions ready to be expressed. Studying them can go on forever and become very exhausting. So here's my final conclusion. In other words, there are so many things that we can do in life. There are so many possibilities. There are so many things that we learn that we should be doing. You can spend your entire life learning. But in verse 13, here is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey his commandments, for this is the duty of every person. God will judge us for everything we do, including every secret thing, whether good or bad. You know, as we get older, we begin to have regrets. Somebody who is 7 years old probably doesn't have a very long list of regrets. Regrets usually involve not getting to go to see somebody's house and play. But when you get older, regrets are a little more substantial. We make choices that define our very existence. And some of those decisions are thoughtful, and others are rash, and the sum of which make our entire life. Regrets are what we take from this life. And I came across an article on an online British newspaper, The Guardian. It's from February 1st of last year. And it was speaking about the regrets of those that are about to leave this life. Here's an excerpt. Bronnie War, if I get her name right, is an Australian nurse who spent several years caring for patients in the last 12 weeks of their lives. She put her observations in a book called The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. She writes of the phenomenal clarity of vision that people gain at the end of their lives and how we might learn from their wisdom. When questioned about any regrets that they've had or anything that they would have done differently, she says common themes surfaced again and again. And so she collected all these. She put these in a first in an article and then into a book. Here are the top 5 regrets of dying as witnessed by her. Number 1, I wished I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the others, not the life others expected of me. So living a life true to yourself, being true to yourself, what are the things you wanted to accomplish in life? Did you do them? Is the family what you wanted it to be? Is your career what you wanted it to be? Is your financial situation where you wanted it to be? Did you have dreams that went unfulfilled? I could have done this. I could have been this. That kind of stuff. Says, people never seem to honor the dreams that they had, and at dying realized how much they missed out on becoming the person that they wanted to be. It really echoes the words we just read in Ecclesiastes, don't it? When you go back to your life and say, I did all the things I thought I wanted to do, but then when I look back, did I really accomplish anything worthwhile? The second point she made was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. This came from every male patient that she nursed. They missed their children's youth, their partner's companionship. And although women spoke of this regret, it was mostly from the men. All of the men I nursed deeply regretted spending so much time of their lives on the treadmill of a work existence. Number three, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. Many people suppress their feelings in order to keep peace with others. As a result, they settled for a mediocre existence and never became who they truly are capable of becoming. Many developed illnesses relating to the bitterness and resentment they carried as a result. Many people just bury pain, and it can come back. Number four, I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. Often, they would not truly realize the full benefits of old friends until their dying weeks, and it was not always possible to track them down. Many had become so caught up in their lives that they had let golden friendships slip over the years. There were many deep regrets about not giving friendships the time and effort that they deserve, and everyone misses the friends they had when they were dying. And the fifth one was, I wished I had let myself be happier. I wish that I let myself be happier. This is a surprisingly common one. Many people do not realize until the end that happiness is a choice. They had stayed stuck in old patterns and habits. The so-called comfort of familiarity overflowed with their emotions as well as their physical lives. Fear of change had them pretending to others and to themselves that they were content, when deep within, they no longer laughed or properly have silliness in their life again. I know I've certainly suffered from this. You decide who you are and who you're going to be. But happiness is a choice. It really struck me the way this says, they stayed stuck in old patterns and habits. Comfort zone. A lot of times we don't have the kind of relationships with God that we want because we don't have the kind of relationships we need with others. And unless we can express ourselves and open and be close to others, how can we really be close to God? We have to have that sort of life that every day you look up and it's about possibilities. And when you go to bed, you think, boy, this was a good day. I got the most out of it. I got the most I can get out of it. These are very common regrets. Living up to our own expectations, keeping the proper balance of work and home life, maintaining close relationships with others, and allowing ourselves to be truly happy in life. We start out in life wanting these things, but life gets in the way. Turn over to Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58 is a favorite passage of mine. When you read it, and we're going to go through and read Isaiah 58, 1 through 14 today. But when you read it, you think, okay, he's talking about ancient Israel, and they were messed up. And they were, on one hand, God's people. On the other hand, they didn't do what God wanted them to do. And so it's easy to be judgeful when you read it and say, yeah, well, if they were being false, if they were being phony, then, you know, I guess they deserve what they get. But this reminds me a lot of patterns that I can become in myself. Well, you go through the motions, you do the right things, you just don't do them for the right reasons. And what I like about this passage is at the end, God tells us what we need to do for this stuff to be real. Isaiah 58, starting in verse 1. I'm going to read this from the New Living Translation, so you can read along if you like. Shout with the voice of a trumpet blast. Tell my people of their sins. Yet they are so pious. They come to the temple every day and seem delighted to hear my laws. You would almost think that it was a righteous nation that would never abandon its God. They love to make a show of coming to me and asking me to take action on their behalf. We have fasted before you, they say. Why aren't you impressed? We have done much penance, and you don't notice it? I will tell you why. It's because you are living for yourself, and even while you are fasting, you keep right on oppressing your workers. What good is fasting when you keep on fighting and quarreling? This kind of fasting will never get you anywhere with me. You humble yourself by going through the motions of penance, bowing your heads like a blade of grass in the wind. You dress in sackcloth and cover yourself with ashes. Is this what you call fasting? Do you really think that this will please the Lord? No, the kind of fasting I want calls you to be free from those. The kind of fasting I want calls you to free those who are wrongly imprisoned and stop oppressing those who work for you. Treat them fairly and give them what they earn. It's talking about walking the walk here. And you think, well, I don't have servants that I oppress, so this doesn't apply to me. But each and every week we come to church and we get all of this instruction, like we were reading about in Ecclesiastes, where all of the tools that we need for happiness are given to us. But at some point, we've got to put them to practice when we're away from here and when we're in our regular lives and when life gets really tough. And if we're not, then in some ways we're living a fraud. We're being one way here and another way somewhere else. I want you to share your food with the hungry and welcome poor wanderers into your homes. Give clothes to those who need them and do not hide from relatives who need your help. If you do these things, your salvation will come like the dawn. Yes, your healing will come quickly. Your godliness will lead you forward, and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. Then when you call, the Lord will answer. Yes, I am here, he will quickly reply. Stop oppressing the helpless, and stop making false accusations and spreading vicious rumors. I mean, this is stuff that we see today. People talking about others negatively. People judging one another. These are things that we see in our regular life. This isn't something you have to live in an ancient kingdom to wrap your brain around. Feed the hungry and help those in trouble. Then your light will shine out from the darkness, and the darkness around you will be as bright as day. The Lord will guide you continually, watering your life when you are dry and keeping you healthy too. You will be like a well-watered garden, like an ever-flowing spring. Your children will rebuild the desert ruins of your cities. Then you will be known as the people who rebuilt their walls and cities. Keep the Sabbath day holy. Don't pursue your own interests on that day, but enjoy the Sabbath and speak of it with delight. You know, we see these things in our lives. If we have a close relationship with God, and he's there to back us up, and we go from day to day, and a tough thing happens, we know we're on the right side. How do you stand up and say, God, if God's with me, who can be against me? unless you're not sure if God is with you. If the first time we ask for God's help, we realize days have gone by, maybe even weeks, that we've had a kind of a close relationship with Him, how can we confidently go through the day if we don't think the same thing about His statutes, His laws, His Sabbaths, as He does, and we're not concerned about living the kind of life that He is hoping we all become more like Him? How can we have confidence that when time gets tough, He will be there for us? Honor the Lord in everything that you do, and don't follow your own desires or talk idly. If you do this, the Lord will be your delight. I will give you great honor and give you your full share of the inheritance I promised to Jacob, your ancestor. I, the Lord, have spoken. What a powerful passage in our Bibles. He said, well, that was just for ancient Israel. Not the way I read it. I think that's for me. I read that and I say, am I the kind of person that when I get down on my knees and pray and I say, God, this is the person I want to be, do I actually live the life that I pretend to be? And I don't mean that we're evil in heart and we get out of there and say, I fooled God, now I can go be that rotten person. I mean, we generally want to be the right kind of person all through our lives. But do we succeed? Many times we want to be close, but we end up very far away. It's kind of like drifting. You know, if you're in a stream and you're in like a raft and you're flowing with current and you can fight the current to stay in a certain place. And you think, okay, I've been working to build my relationship with God. I've been studying. I've been reading. I've done all these things. And I feel really good. And then as soon as you quit, you feel yourself drifting down the river again. And in a very short amount of time, you're way away from where you were. That's because that's what life is. Satan is the god of this world, and he has engineered this world to pull us away from God as quickly as possible if we are not careful. It's like swimming upstream. Mr. Light likes to talk about the salmon run and those swimming upstream, and that's the life that God has called us to live. To spend a life swimming against the tide. That's the world that we live in. So how do we break this cycle? If you want to get out of this rental agreement cycle, and you want to get into this ownership cycle, to where you have peace of mind, and that you can say on any given day, you know, I was just talking about this to God the other day, and I think I'm seeing what He wants me to see in this. How do you break this cycle? Well, every good relationship is based on love. And God's love for us is clear. He created this existence. You think, how is that love? Well, remember, the angels were created eternally. They could live forever. And they made mistakes, and they will suffer forever. Our existence is not forever, and our mistakes are not forever. That's a blessing. That is merciful. This existence allows us to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling, as it says in our scriptures. It's a wonderful gift that God has given us, so that we do not have to fear an eternity of torment. If somebody chooses not to live God's way of life and says, God, I see what you're offering, I don't want it. You know, many in the world would like to say, well, then you're going to be burning in hell forever and ever and ever. But we read in the Bible, that's not the way it happens. That's not true. That's a complete and utter lie. If you do not want God's way of life, then we won't have it. And your life will end. The wages of sin is death, not torment. The Bible is very clear. So we have this existence that God gave us to work out our own salvation. He's loved us first. That's why we can love Him. He's given us the way of peace. He's given us this book that has all the information we need to get through our life and be successful, to overcome this world. It's all in here, and it's all in our relationship with Him. But do we love God? And if so, how do we show that love? If we are to move from a rental relationship with God to one of ownership, we must reciprocate that love He has already shown us. Today, I'd like to leave you three ways that we can improve our relationship with God. I didn't choose love as one of them because, let's face it, if you don't have love, what do you have? You have nothing. So we're going from the assumption that we all have love for God and that we all want what He wants from us. So as that is our starting point, what are three ways we can improve our relationship with God? First point here is every relationship needs mutual respect. This isn't just a relationship with God, this is a relationship with one another. If we don't show respect to our family, to our friends, to our coworkers, to our neighbors, and even to complete strangers, then we won't have a good relationship. I like watching old movies. You ever notice in old movies, everybody is Mr. This or Mrs. That? Everybody is formal and respectful to one another. You wouldn't just call somebody by their first name unless you knew them. People dressed up to go out of their house. They wore casual clothes. It was because they were working around the house. And maybe that's just in old movies. But it sure makes me think that life could be a lot better if we wanted it to be. Every relationship needs mutual respect. Now, it goes without saying that we need to respect God. But then again, we should discuss this idea of mutual respect. You know, God respects us. He respects us. It's easy to get in this thought that, well, God is the king of the universe, the emperor of all things, and He wants us to live a certain way, and we don't. So therefore, we're in this Lord and servant relationship, and we're always trying to make ourselves better and to live up to God, and we never seem to do that. That's not really the way it is. God has a tremendous amount of respect for us. You ever consider the fact that this existence that He gave us to work out our own salvation, He's the one that gave us short memories. He's the one that made us forget the path that we were on. He made the physical life that can so easily ensnare us and get us, oh, look at that, and get us distracted. He knows the life that we have and the distraction we have. He knows the carnal mind is enmity against Him. And so He is patient. You ever thought about how patient God is? Just think, if you've been in the church for decades, how patient has He been with you? He's been very patient with me, I'll tell you that. Decades go by before I learned certain lessons. He could certainly require that I am right there, right now. But He doesn't. He gives us time. Because He knows that a relationship is based on mutual respect. It's give and take. He gives, we take. But it's amazing how much respect He gives us. Ancient Israel, we read about them all the time. They'd always get themselves into trouble. They're always going after false gods, always giving up all of the statutes and judgments that God gave them and just threw them away, follow after their own fears and lusts and all these other things. But you know, a careful reading of the Old Testament will find that Israel was given 7 years of peace for every year of bondage. And even though they earned the exact opposite of that, God always gave them time. Just like He gives us time. And He gives us help. He sends the help we need along the way to tell us where we need to be and what we need to be doing, not so that we can be good enough, so that we can find peace, maybe allow ourselves to have some of that happiness. You know, not all of my prayers are formal. and I hope yours aren't either. Sometimes my prayers are just quite casual. I realize that I can't always put the time in that I want to in certain occasions, but I can't just go through the day and not have a relationship with God. I remember a number of times going, well, I didn't take time to pray today, so I'm not listening to the radio. I'm going to punish myself. I'm going to go to work without listening to the radio. And I sit there in silence, punish myself all the way to work. There. What did that accomplish? What did that accomplish? So I thought, why not just talk to God on the way to work? Say, I didn't pray like I wanted to today, so let's just talk. And it's quite informal. But when I do take the time to pray properly, I want to come to God and show Him the respect that He deserves. He is the supreme being. And therefore, I think to myself, how should I address Him? You know, we have the model prayer we could go over, you could go over, and things that we should be thinking about and covering when we pray. But there's some simple things that I try to do in my own life. Taking a cue from the burning bush, I remove my shoes. If I've gotten dressed for work, I sit down and take my shoes off. Just a sign of respect. Wearing a hat at dinner, I do the prayer for dinner, take my hat off. Just little signs of respect. Just show God, you're supreme, I am not. I want you to know that. That's why we bow. You may have other ways that you show God respect. One of the most important things is how we are in our life. Do we show God respect by honoring His way of life? Or do we allow His name to be wrung through the mud when we don't live God's way of life? And someone sees us and says, wow, you're that kind of person? I didn't know. Showing respect for God, because He shows us respect. Number two, every relationship needs good communication. Now, this might seem redundant after just discussing prayer, but as everyone knows, good communication is a two-way street. Prayer is often one way, and I will tell you that I've had God put ideas into my head during prayer, so it's not like there is no incoming messages when you're praying. But it's not conversational. And so that's why I try to take more and more time out of my day, whenever I can, to just have a conversation. Because when you begin opening up different parts of your life, you know, there are things that we think we're hiding from God in our lives. We're not. There's nothing in our lives that are hidden from God. So why are they hidden from our conversations with Him? It's like not wanting to admit that I wasn't going to take that car to college. Why pray to God about it? He may tell me not to. And then I'll have a point of conscience to deal with. So I just leave it out. Won't mention it. Nothing is secret from God. You know, I go through this book a lot because of the sermons that I prepare. But I get a lot out of this book when I'm not using it to prepare a sermon. Because when you're just reading this, it's when God speaks to you. You know, I was reading through Ecclesiastes. Part of it because Lisa mentioned, it's just, the book bothers me that it seems so dark. You know, it's all meaningless. Life is just pointless. It goes on and says over and over again. And I had a scripture I wanted to read from there, and I said, I just need to go through this and spend some time with this. And what God was saying to me was, it's not all meaningless unless you allow it to be. I don't want your life to be meaningless. And you get this when you read from His Word. You have to read from this book if you want to hear God's words to you. They're not just written to people who have died 4,000, 5,000 years ago. It was recorded because he wants every one of us to read these words and say, I think he's speaking to me here. I think this applies to my life. This is what we were talking about in the car the other day. Wow, how come I didn't see this? Every relationship needs two-way good communication. It takes effort. Philippians 4:19 in the New Living Translation puts it this way. And this same God who takes care of the will, the same God who takes care of me will supply all your needs from his glorious riches, which have been given to us in Christ Jesus. God wants a relationship with us. He gives us so much more than just the things that we need. We get a place to sleep at night. We get something to eat. Those are needs. But we have wants, and God knows what they are. God has wants too, and he wants a relationship with us. And remember what we were reading in Isaiah 58. Go back and read that sometime. And listen for the parts that came out, and it says, if you do these things for the right reasons, if you live the life that I want you to live, if you remain close with God, then I will be there immediately. Then I will give you what you need. You will be like a well-watered garden. When you want plants to grow, you don't wait for them to wither before you water them. You water them in advance. The ground is moist and it's ready for new life to grow into, and it's a hospitable place to grow. That's what he's talking about. In our lives, we could have that kind of relationship with him, that all of our needs, all of our wants, all of the things that we need to be happy are given to us in advance. So we need to be close to him. But like what Isaiah 58 is talking about, brings us to our third point. Our relationship will grow strong if we hunger and thirst for his righteousness. That's what was missing in ancient Israel. They did not hunger and thirst for righteousness. They realized the requirements as put on them by God, and so they tried to live it. Maybe you've known people over the years that kept the Sabbath because, well, we're supposed to keep the Sabbath, right? Why do you keep the Sabbath? Because we're supposed to? If that's somebody's answer, they're probably not going to be here very long. I like when Mike tells me that the Sabbath is a delight, and when Jim says, I don't want to be anywhere else but here on the Sabbath, because that's the way I feel about it. The Sabbath is a delight. We need to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Matthew 5, verse 6 says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. If that's what you want out of life, God says, you'll get it. Guaranteed. If you want this, if this is what you want out of life, God promises you in Matthew 5 and verse 6 that you will get it. And that's what they needed in Isaiah 58. And that's what we need. To be the kind of person that God wants us to be. If we truly want a life of righteousness, then we got to spend some time in this book. And when we read it, we will hear God speaking to us through this book, which represents his son and the relationship we're supposed to have with him. Jesus Christ will return to this earth. Until then, we can spend time with Jesus Christ, the Word of God, this book. If we truly want righteousness in our lives and start to live this life that actually brings happiness, which is where, yes, we have to deny the flesh. We do have to deny the flesh. I had a meeting with my doctor this last week. On top of all the wonderful, horrible news that we've gotten this last week, doctor says, yeah, you got to kind of change your life if you want to live here very long. I mean, I've got no real health problems right there that I know of. But denying self, That's something we have to do in this life. Because our bodies will tell us, I want this, I want that. For some people, it's ice cream. For me, it's cookies. Everybody's got something their body wants. It's not necessarily good for you. And so we have to deny self. But the things that our bodies want never bring happiness. That's the point. If you indulge the flesh, you will never, ever find happiness. Happiness comes for becoming the person that God says leads to happiness. Happiness comes from doing the things and being the person that God says brings peace. Or regrets in life. I've got regrets, but they're not big regrets. There's some. There's definitely some regrets. But I'm on the right path. I've got the right goal in front of me. So if that's in front of me, how could the regrets in my life be that big of a deal? There are some. And I think we can all improve in everything that we have in this life. But like the scripture says, if God be for us, who can be against us? So if you're tired of renting your relationship with God, then give these a try. If you're sick of feeling guilty about having to turn to God when you know your back has been to Him for way too long, then take a proactive approach and get to know Him before you are desperate. If you want to take ownership and build a lasting relationship with God, then let's show Him the respect He deserves. Let's spend time getting to know Him, and let's hunger and thirst for His righteousness.